Good afternoon. From the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery. Four Alaskans appointed by Governor Mike Dunleavy to serve on various state boards and commissions recently resigned ahead of a legislative confirmation vote expected next week. Dunleavy told legislators in a series of letters on Friday and Monday that the four had left their seats. Two were the subject of significant controversy. A Dunleavy appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council, Veronica Lambertson of Bird Creek, made headlines last week when senators questioned her on a number of fringe beliefs she'd posted about on social media. Here she is at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. She was questioned by Senator Matt Clayman, an Anchorage Democrat.
Do I believe something happened at the Holocaust and a tragedy and a lot of people died? Yes, I believe that actually happened. Are we being told the true story about it all? No, I don't believe we're being told the true story about it all.
What do you believe is the true story?
That I don't know yet.
Another senator questioned whether Lambertson was even eligible. Dunleavy appointed her to a seat reserved from people from small communities, and Lambertson lives within Anchorage's municipal boundaries. Another resigning appointee, Alaska Judicial Council member John Wood, also faced questions over whether he was eligible to serve. Wood is a former attorney and was appointed to a seat reserved for non-attorneys. A Superior Court judge found he was eligible, though an appeal remains unresolved. Wood says he's not resigning over the controversy, nor was he asked to step aside. Wood says he'd simply rather not have to schedule family reunions around the Judicial Council's activities. The other two resigning appointees are North Pole resident Victoria Acree, who Dunleavy appointed to the Board of Massage Therapists in November, and Board of Nursing appointee Ashley Shawley. Neither faced a public hearing. Legislators have the power to reject nominees with a simple majority vote. The remains of a woman found in a wooded area in Spinard and Anchorage last week have been identified as Kelly Hunt, a 19-year-old college student from Choctulik, missing since January. Hunt had been staying at a home in the same neighborhood and was last seen leaving on the morning of January 7th. Her family reported her missing 4 days later. Advocates for missing and murdered Indigenous people have questioned the police response that followed. Michael Livingston, a retired Anchorage police officer and MMIP advocate, said Hunt's case reflects a pattern he's seen too often.
Far too often, when a young Alaska Native woman is reported missing, it's too late, and we are now looking at human remains.
Livingston says several red flags in Hunt's disappearance should have prompted a more aggressive investigation. He said Hunt had left her purse behind, with money inside, as well as clothing, signs she did not plan to be gone long.
Was there any more that anybody could have done to try to have located her early on in the game to see whether or not any video surveillance cameras or people in the neighborhood might have seen anything suspicious?
Livingston says he would like to see an investigation into the police response. Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case said he would be happy to discuss this with advocates, but for now, the ability of investigators to talk about the case is very limited.
Some people look at that as a missing person, and we should put all that information out to the public and make everything publicly available so everybody knows what we're doing. But the problem is that can really cause challenges if it does become a criminal investigation later on.
Case says one of the challenges was the four-day gap between the time that Hunt went missing and her disappearance was reported. Case says he doesn't blame anyone for the delay.
And so we had detectives involved in that case from the beginning, and we investigated that just in case that was turned into a crime.
Case says police followed up on numerous leads, including vehicles and people of interest. He says the department's crime scene team continues to process evidence as investigators wait for the chief medical examiner to determine the exact cause of death. So far, no arrests have been made. And a bill that would reinstate a pension system for state and local government employees is on the verge of a state Senate vote, which would bring it closer than ever to Governor Mike Dunleavy's desk. It's a major priority for leaders of the bipartisan coalitions controlling the House and Senate. But the Senate's version of the bill requires local governments to pitch in more. And as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, some say they can't afford to.
For Representative Chuck Kopp, the Anchorage Republican and former police officer who's led the most recent push to reinstate a pension system for state and local government employees, there are plenty of reasons to return to a defined benefit retirement plan. Look no further, he says, than the recently released statewide single audit, which for the second year in a row identified 80-plus issues with state officials' compliance with federal and state law and regulations, in part because Alaska just can't hang on to knowledgeable staff.
We're getting, you know, tens of millions of dollars in fines, or we're not submitting requests for reimbursement. One grant we were owed over $290 million. That's a lot of money in our operating budget today. The staff didn't know to submit the request for reimbursement.
COP also points to overtime and other types of so-called premium pay. Those have come in tens of millions over budget as the state struggles, like many Alaska employers, to attract and retain qualified staff. And there's some evidence a pension system could help. Economists have told legislators that a pension system is especially valuable for retaining the mid and late career government employees who hold invaluable institutional knowledge, like, you know, that you should submit for reimbursement. Efforts to reinstate a pension system have come in fits and starts since the state closed its pension system to new employees 2 decades ago. The biggest roadblock has always been the cost, and fundamentally that's a hard thing to project because it depends on a lot of variables. But the most recent estimate is the new pension system would cost an average of nearly $90 million a year for the first 13 years, and COP says that would basically pay for itself.
Right now, the state of Alaska is paying in excess of $200 million a year in overtime and premium pay, that's call-out pay to cover shift vacancies and people just not being there to do the job, filling critical line positions, because we're that short-staffed.
But budgeters in the Senate Finance Committee say they're concerned the plan could wind up underfunded. The state actuary's analysis shows costs ramping up as time goes on, and Alaska is still paying off billions in unfunded liabilities created when the state got bad actuarial advice in the early 2000s, which led it to close the pension program. So before shipping the pension bill off to the Senate floor on Friday, senators added a few tweaks, including one that increases the amount that non-state employers, like local governments and housing authorities, have to contribute to the plan. Here's Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican who's long been skeptical of returning to a pension system.
There are increased costs. If you want more benefits, it costs more. If you want less, it costs less. Somebody has to pay the costs. And the state of Alaska is responsible for the state employees, but we're not responsible for the non-state employees.
Many local governments, though, say they can't afford to pay more. A bevy of local officials told senators the plan wasn't workable. Here's the city administrator for Stedman's home community of Sitka, John Leach.
This bill is an unfunded mandate dressed up as a workforce benefit, and Sitka cannot absorb it. And I suspect many of my colleagues across the state cannot either.
The bill that advanced from committee gives cities and other non-state employers the choice to join the new pension system or stick with the existing defined contribution system, which could come with complications of its own. But COP and other pension advocates, like Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel, say there's no reason to push more costs onto local government. Geisel says the newly reformulated pension plan included in House Bill 78 begins fully funded, has mechanisms to adjust contributions up and down to keep it funded, and that there's little risk overall of underfunding.
The actuary has identified that it would take a significant black swan event of 3 years of no returns for this particular pension to fall below 90% funded.
The bill is expected to hit the Senate floor in the coming days. If it passes, it would go back to the House for a concurrence vote, which would send the bill to the governor. Governor Mike Dunleavy has not said publicly whether he'll sign or veto it. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
And you're listening to Tongass Voices, perspectives from the homelands of the Occoquan and beyond. You've likely seen Brian Wallace around town, and odds are he was carrying a camera. Wallace has been taking photos of Juneau people, places, and happenings since he was a kid. He worked as a photojournalist at the Juneau Empire for nearly 30 years. And he comes from a family of artists. His father, the late Amos Wallace, was a renowned carver. Wallace takes pictures of the present for future generations. He's also working to memorialize the past, his own families, and Juneau's.
My name is Brian Wallace, semi-world-famous photographer here in Juneau, Alaska. Well, I was a photographer for the local newspaper for 28 years, 6 months, so I've seen a lot of people grow up, a lot of people around town, a lot of people recognize me. You know, it's hard for me to sneak out of town or be anywhere. I like trying to be anonymous when I travel. Last time I was in New York City, I saw on a Facebook post, someone said, oh my God, I just saw Brian Wallace crossing Times Square. She gave the whole rundown of what I was wearing, what direction I was heading, you know, so that kind of blew my cover. You know, I was trying to sneak out of town and I was caught. I think around fifth or sixth grade, my older brother Roger, who was taking photographs for the Junior Douglas High School Totem Yearbook, and I kind of wanted to copy him with taking pictures and developing images. So that you know, seemed like magic to me, you know, just take a picture, use the enlarger, project something down onto a piece of paper, dump it in chemicals, and all of a sudden, like magic, you know, the image appears. Technology is real amazing now, the digital. Back when I started, I had like maybe two rolls, 72 exposures to cover a whole story, and now I take like several hundred to several thousand. I photograph celebration, there's thousands of dancers, so there's going to be many thousands of images. And so narrowing down to, you know, 20, 25 decisive moments that would define the event is a real, it's a lot of work. I'm a full-time employee at the Alaska State Museum. One of my jobs that I do is to photograph some artifacts, photographing the hands-on objects as well as other stuff that people aren't allowed to hold, but we need a visual record of that. It just amazes me photographing, you know, the old Tlingit artifacts, the blankets, even the mysterious ivory artifacts that were dug out of the tundra. You know, we have no idea what they were used for, but some person made it, you know, long before the Egyptian pyramids were built. It's been very thrilling for me to photograph all of my late father's work. He has some totem poles in museums in New York City, and I made pilgrimages there to photograph it. And one big one in Cincinnati, you know, I've traveled throughout the whole country trying to track down all the totem poles that he made. I'm still looking for the ones that he carved for Disneyland back in the 1950s, but their archivist hasn't been able to locate them for me. I'm trying to round up as much artwork that my dad did. He did literally hundreds, maybe thousands of bracelets, and they're all out there in the world. And I've maybe photographed about 20 or 30 of them so far. Anytime someone says, hey, my mom had a bracelet that was given to her in 1961, says, can I photograph it? I'm a big fan of my dad and his work, and I just don't want it to fade away. I'm not a trained historian, but history has always been like one of my favorite subjects since high school. So I've really pursued my images to preserve things for posterity. When I put photographs out, people say, oh, that's great. That reminds me of this certain time. Or if I find photographs of an elder who has passed, but someone who I photographed 40 years ago, I could show them the images, and that kind of makes a lot of people's days.
That was Juneau photographer Brian Wallace talking about his love of photography as a way to preserve both the past and the present for future generations. And it's 50 degrees and cloudy this afternoon in Juneau. You're listening to KTOO.